Dateline, Deseret News, July 16, 1910. Quote, the 5th Ward LDS Chapel, which is situated on 2nd West between 7th and 8th South, is now in the course of construction. When it is completed, it will cost about $15,000. It is being built of red brick with white sandstone facing and will be beautifully furnished. Cannon and Fetzers are the architects, and it is considered one of the best plans for a ward chapel that have been submitted so far. End quote. I'm Wendy.
I'm Chris.
And this is Demolished Places. Hello and welcome to episode 33 and our first episode as Demolished Places. We were so pleased with all of your support that you gave us in rebranding the podcast. Thank you all so much. We just really appreciated the support and we're happy that you're going to stick around and go on this new journey with us.
Yes, the support was great and the feedback was also great.
So it's been a while since our last episode, about 4 months.
Yes.
Yeah. And that's because we have both been very busy. But Chris, do you want to talk about what you have been working on?
Yeah, I've been doing some consulting work around local historic districts and messaging. I recently just did messaging around the Laird Avenue and Princeton Avenue local historic districts and helped them get those through the city council and passed. And I've also been helping save a few buildings around the city. We currently just saved a very historic home by getting owners in it that want to preserve it. And then we also saved a large historic building downtown that was sold, and the new owners will be preserving it. And it will be something that the community will love and cherish for years to come. But that we can't disclose that until the end of August, unfortunately. So look out for that news.
And we just recorded an episode earlier with
the Laird and Princeton local historic district ladies that did the application and walked it through the process.
And we're really excited to tell their story. So look for that episode to come out a little bit later in the summer.
Yeah, it's a very good story arc. And I think a lot of people can learn about their messaging and how they did it and how they really changed the talk around historic preservation in Salt Lake.
They really did. And they set up so many other neighborhoods in the city to be able to get a local historic district designation. Yeah. So we're excited for that. But today we're going to talk about the illegal demolition of the historic Fifth Ward Meeting House located at 740 South 300 West in Salt Lake City. So this had just an enormous impact on many aspects of the community and the city. And there is a lot to unpack here.
Indeed.
So before we get started, let's start with the history of the Fifth Ward. In 1849, the LDS Church divided the city into 19 units of 9 blocks each. Each ward was headed by a bishop appointed by the church. So dividing the city into wards made it easier to help individuals and families get settled and build homes, run businesses. And it was easier to have one bishop over a small community than who was ever in charge of the LDS Church at the time try to be over all of the city. So each ward had a meeting house for religious meetings, community gatherings, and a place to conduct business. The Fifth Ward was among the first of these 19 wards. Its boundaries were from 6th South to 10th South and 3rd West to the Jordan River, which is roughly about 7th West. The original ward members were largely farmers, and it's kind of hard to imagine that area as farmland these days because it's so industrialized.
Yeah, it really is.
The ward's first meeting house was a small adobe structure that eventually fell down, which was not uncommon of the original adobe structures in that were built in Salt Lake. It took a bit to figure it out.
Yeah, learning that they need foundations and also just the sand clay mixture of the adobe brick was something that early settlers weren't the best at.
Right. The second building was much more structurally sound, but the ward outgrew it. In 1910, a big new meeting house was constructed. The meeting house was designed by Cannon and Fetzer, and some of their buildings that you might recognize around town are the Wasatch Plunge Building at 840 North 300 West, West High School at 241 North 300 West, the 20th Ward Chapel, which was also a little bit later than those first original 19 wards, and that is on 2nd Avenue. And heading down to Cedar City, the Cedar City Main Post Office. So shout out to Cedar City. It was built in the Tudor Gothic style and is a two-story T-shaped plan. And Chris, being the historic architecture expert, can you tell us a little bit about what that means, what Tudor Gothic style is?
Yeah, so Tudor Gothic is an English style. So the primary style there is a Tudor style. So it's really a Tudor revival because Tudor style was several hundred years before this period in England. And the secondary style is Gothic. So it is built in the Tudor style with Gothic ornamentation or features that would make it a Tudor Gothic. It's really notable for this time frame because there were not a lot of Gothic style buildings in Salt Lake. In fact, there currently are very few that have survived here, right, especially because they just were not popular. And that's what makes this building significant, or at least part of it.
Right, right. So the final cost to build it was around $20,000. The interior consisted of the chapel proper on the main floor, Sunday school rooms on the second floor, and a stage, kitchen, Relief Society room, and boiler room in the basement. In March of 1937, the front of the chapel was torn down to make room for additional classrooms, a bishop's office, and a new boiler and heating room. So these renovations totaled about $22,500, and they were really meant to improve the quality of the programs at the chapel. And over the years, the changing character of the neighborhood, which from farming to more industrial, led to a decline in membership because as the industries moved in, a lot of those original family homes were demolished.
Yeah, the granary really took off and it's right next to it.
Right. Well, along with the membership, the use of the building also declined. And so in 1975, the LDS Church sold the building and it was vacant on and off until the late 80s. And then it was inhabited by various clubs and businesses until about 2005. So some of the more notable renters were the Pompadour, and that's where Nirvana and Smashing Pumpkins played long before they were Nirvana and Smashing Pumpkins. there was a few escort services, and that caused some controversy within the city. Club Fusion, Club Vesuvius, Sanctuary, which a lot of our Instagram followers were remembering their time spent at Sanctuary, Tibetan Buddhist Temple, and Red Lotus School of Movement. The building was listed on the National Register of Historic Places in 1978 and is also a Salt Lake City landmark site. Now, those are two very different things, but both come into play in this story. So, Chris, can you tell us the difference between those two?
Yeah, so when it was registered on the National Register of Historic Places, again, we've talked about this in previous episodes, that is largely an honorary thing. It does not actually protect the building from demolition. What it does, though, is it gives tax credit accessibility to the owners of it. So it allows the history to be collected and to be documented. And then it helps those people that own it, the owners, preserve it through the use of tax credits. The local landmark site designation is completely different. It's where the city designates it as a local landmark, and it has the same protections as local historic districts and contributing structures within the local historic district receive. So in that vein, the building is protected. It cannot be demolished unless it has a certificate of appropriateness. And usually those are very hard to get. It really has to be in like complete disrepair when the owner gets it, or it has to be a safety issue, or there has to be like a very severe economic hardship issue with it. It's not an easy bar to clear. And so that's why this is such an issue with this building and what happened to it, because it was supposed to be protected.
Right.
And what happened to it did not have a permit, did not have a certificate of appropriateness.
Right. Yeah. We'll dive into that whole timeline coming up. The building, from what I can tell, has pretty much been vacant since 2005. And that's when Red Lotus School of Movement moved out. They sold it.
Yeah. And I went to this site the day after Easter, and I was there for several hours on site talking to people that were going by. I talked to several city officials. The chief of police stopped by, talked to him, and, you know, was just hearing their stories and documenting the destruction, getting photos of it so we could talk about it on, you know, Instagram and Facebook and also on the podcast. But I happened to be there when the owner of it, the previous owner, was there, and she owned it when it was the Buddhist temple, and also I believe the Red Lotus School of Movement. They changed it into that after the Buddhist temple. It was a nonprofit that owned it. And when she sold it, she told me that they sold it to a gentleman that promised to restore and preserve this place. And, you know, she felt like she let this building down. And I told her, you did not let this building down. The current owners did.
Right.
And so, you know, it's a sad situation. She preserved this place on a shoestring budget, and she made it work. And right. Then to have other people come in behind her that had considerably more money and more access to resources not keep it up is really damning and really sad.
Right. So we do know that Tag Salt Lake, which is owned by Jordan Atkins, purchased the building, and he was the owner of the building at the day of question.
Yes.
So that brings us to Sunday, March 31st, which just happened to be Easter Sunday, when two city planners, they came across workers demolishing the front of the building, and they asked the workers for a permit, and the workers said they had one, but eventually the workers stopped working and left the site. Mm-hmm. And that's when they actually left their construction equipment behind. They just vacated the site.
They didn't leave the site. They ran from the site. Like it was a full-blown, we're in trouble, we're out of here.
Uh-oh. So the city was notified, and a stop work order was issued that day.
Yeah. This is really commendable by the city. Just a little bit more color on this situation. You know, Easter Sunday, the city staff were not working, and the planners came by. They actually notified their boss, who is the head of the planning division. He was at home sick with COVID and came down to put the stop order on it and to chase these people off.
Wow.
I mean, this was really city employees going above and beyond for their job, and it's very commendable.
Right.
And they saved this building, and we should be happy they did so, and also very appreciative of their work.
Yes. Yes. So, let's lay out what we know. So we know that Atkins was planning to demolish the building because he took some steps necessary for a commercial demolition permit. So according to an article by Building Salt Lake, he hired an inspector to check for asbestos and signed for a quality control permit on March 14th. And said the entire building would be demolished starting like the end of March, like the 28th. However, a commercial demo permit was never issued, and there is no permit for the site on record with the city. Mm-mm. So those steps that he took were steps to apply for the permit, but there were no applications.
Yes, and he has a history of working with the city and working with these properties. He knows the process. And there is really no excuse on his behalf for what happened. He is well aware it was a landmark site, and he knows the process.
Right.
So I think, you know, if you read in between the lines here, which we have to.
Which we do.
it really just came down to he told this crew, and the crew is on record of, and they have done several interviews on this, saying it was Jared Atkins himself that hired them and that he directed it. So right. Jared Atkins' response to this when it initially happened looks to all be fabricated at this point.
Right, right. And I mean, he did say that in, I don't know if it was on Twitter or through interviews, I can't remember what, but he, you know, had said, like, I don't know what's going on.
Or it's a miscommunication.
It's a miscommunication. I'm working to get to the bottom of this. But I think you're right, reading between the lines, the fact that this happened on Easter Sunday, mm-hmm. you know, during, like, a time when people are going to be home with their families, try to Try to sneak it through.
When the city is going to be shut down.
Right. Now, okay, so you talked about the landmark, the having it as a Salt Lake landmark. And so getting a commercial permit for this building, like, it's not a normal process. Is like, say you're wanting to demolish the local like gas station on the corner.
Yeah, you have to go through the local landmark commission to get that permit, and you know there's very stringent rules around that and ordinances, and it would have been honestly probably a year long process to get these permits. It would have been a while,
right?
And that process wasn't even started.
No. And you were talking about the owner of the demo company, and they said they have worked with Atkins on other jobs and that he always had the permit. And they did say that, you know, it was probably it was bad on their side that they just assumed that he had the right permits. They paid him. They told him what to do. I don't necessarily fault. I think they were doing what they were, but they have said going in the future, they will always make sure that they have the proper permits before they do any work for anybody.
Yeah, yeah.
So the city, like you were saying, the city took action immediately. And you were down there on the day of the site. You said you were talking with, you know, community members or, you know, the local police department. And they were there because they needed to secure the site.
Yeah. So immediately the city put a fence up around it the very next day. They responded very quickly to this. They had people coming by surveying it. City planners were there. The police were there a couple times throughout the day checking on it, making sure people weren't looting it or causing other issues.
Right. And they did have that problem. I spoke to a couple of followers that said they ran people off that were collecting bricks and saying, yeah, well, it's already demolished. They don't need these bricks.
Yeah, when I was there on site, there was actually a lady. I mean, she had the best of intentions. She came up and was taking bricks, and she said that she was going to do an art project with the bricks, and she wanted to do it to, like, remember the building. And I had to ask her to please stop and to put those bricks back because, you know, it's actively an investigation going on, and you are messing with that investigation
right
by taking those materials away. There's also historic markers that
yes
were on the church
yes
that from 1910 that were just laying there that people could have took.
Right.
And so the city did gate it off. They also did the boarding up on it. They boarded it up so people couldn't get into it. Also, and also to keep the elements out the best they could. So the city did take swift action on those fronts. But also this coincides with an update to ordinances around certificate of appropriateness.
Right. And can you explain what certificate of appropriateness is?
So it's basically, it gives people the right to change properties like this.
Okay.
And it has to go through the Landmark Commission. And this was already happening in the background with the mayor's office and city staff and also Landmark Commission. This changed this ordinance where it went through the Landmark Commission. They sent it through to the city, and then the city adjusted those recommendations based on what they thought they could legally do and couldn't based on Utah state law.
Right.
So, yeah, this really just coincided at the perfect time because most of those ordinances were like in their final stages. They're ready for city review. And the very next council meeting, which was just days after,
right,
2 days after, the city presented those recommendations to the city council and walked them through what not only what happened here on this site, but what will happen with these ordinances going forward and what they're going to change.
Yep. Let's back up just a little bit here, because I know people are saying, and we've talked to a few people that have said, well, why would he do this if he knew he would have to, you know, rebuild the building or all of this? So let's talk about what laws were in place that Atkins may have understood would happen to him.
Yeah, so, you know, some laws that were in place was like a $10,000 fine for demolition, which is just sort of what business owners like this calculating the cost of doing business to them, like $10,000 is nothing, right? They'll absorb that $10,000 cost. There were some boarding fees. They were very low. And also, I think the thing that he underestimated here was that I don't think he thought about the city forcing him to rebuild. That was right. Already an ordinance that if a local historic landmark like this is demolished or partially tore down, city ordinance already was in place that it would have to be rebuilt. And so that is an important part of this.
Right. So he pretty much thought that he would basically have to pay $10,000 in fine, slap on the wrist.
Yeah.
And then be able to demolish the rest of the building and do whatever he wanted with the site. So on April 17th, the city council voted to adopt updates to working without a certificate of appropriateness. They were some pretty severe updates.
Yeah.
I don't think severe is the right word, but
strong.
Strong, yes.
It really moved forward these ordinances and really added another layer of protection to make it to where developers can no longer see this as just a cost of doing business. It now has more teeth to it, where if they do it, it could really harm them in the process. And I think that is the linchpin here,
right,
where it really makes these a wonderful update. And the city should be happy these were passed.
Yes.
Because it's going to really protect a lot of our historic structures, a lot of our local history. It's going to stop the flattening of our state,
right,
our city. And it's going to really help preserve that place and that uniqueness that makes Salt Lake what it is.
Right. Do you want to touch on some of those bigger
points to points? The ordinances?
Yeah.
Yeah. So some of the points are, is that if work is done without a COA, the contributing structure will have to sit until a COA is issued. And the fine for that is $250 a day. So that's in a local historic district with a contributing structure. It's even worse for a landmark site like this. It is $500 a day if this happens. So that the owner of that is gonna have to pay $500 a day until they fix the issue.
Right.
And then before starting work now on these structures, permits must be visible on site so the public can see it, and also workers on site before starting work can see it.
Right.
So no more, we have a permit, we just don't know where it is. It has to be on site posted in a visible manner.
Yes.
Also, a new boarding fee will be charged for issues like this. If something happens like this in the future with these sites, it's $14,850 a year the city will charge for boarding to keep this boarding up until a COA is issued on it. Also, the reconstruction process has now been improved where they talk about appropriate materials and appropriate, and they have more of a process set up around it of how these buildings have to be rebuilt.
Right. I mean, we're talking like appropriate, period appropriate
materials.
Yeah.
Same size, form, fit, function as the original. I mean, it really has to go back to what it was as close as it can.
Yes.
Of course, you know, you're going to lose some of that historic wood, the brick and stuff, unfortunately. But when you look at the building, the end result should be that you see the same building as before or very close to it.
Right. And for anyone who thinks that that's not something that can be enforced, there was a homeowner in, I believe, the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area, that demolished his house without proper permits. And they made him rebuild the house to exactly how it was using period appropriate materials. And even like as far as some of the ways that he had to rebuild the house had to be period appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
He had to return the structure to what it was before he demolished it. So yes, this is enforceable.
Yeah, it is. And then also it really strengthened the economic hardship process where right. now if this happens, the homeowner cannot claim economic hardship for issues they caused.
Right.
So if they demolish it, that's out the window. You don't get to claim that now.
No, you don't get to say I can't afford to rebuild it.
And, you know, if you do demo by neglect, you don't get to claim that now.
I love that so much because that is such a problem that we have
seen.
Huge
problem.
I mean, we've talked about numerous buildings on this podcast that were demolished due to neglect.
Yes. And my favorite, too, that this enforces is that, you know, if this building is sitting vacant, and you've done something without a certificate of appropriateness, and then somebody goes in and lights fire to it, which has happened so many times
suspicious
in the city.
Suspicious fires.
Guess what? You don't get to claim economic hardship.
So.
Because you caused it.
Right. Yeah.
And then the last big one, and I think this is like the kicker that makes this really hard for developers to get away with this. If a landmark site or a contributing structure is demolished and not replaced, if they just like walk away from it and they say, I'm not rebuilding this, that lot has to sit vacant for 25 years.
And so they're sitting on a lot that isn't making any money for them.
Yeah. It strips away that economic activity they were hoping for.
Right.
So it makes it where, you know, if you're a developer or just an average everyday Joe thinking you're going to do this and get away with it, you're not anymore.
No.
You're going to sit on that for 25 years.
No. I am so thrilled with these new laws because it's something that we have needed badly in the city.
Yeah, we should, you know, thank the Historic Landmark Commission.
Yes.
Because these went through them and there were recommendations from them. We should thank the city, their employees, the mayor's office, because they really pushed for these. And also the city council. The city council sped these up and they voted on this Tuesday, actually, the 16th.
Yeah.
They took public comments and they just voted to approve it to get it through.
And thank you to all the public who made comments.
Yeah.
Like your voice mattered.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, this is really a wonderful thing to happen. Utah, it needed to happen a while ago. And I'm hopeful that other cities will adopt these ordinances and codes.
I am too. Okay. So what happens to the Fifth Ward Meeting House now?
The city has said it must be rebuilt. We will see.
We will see.
Because a lot of these changes aren't grandfathered in.
Right.
Unfortunately. However, if new damage happens to it because of what happened,
then
they take effect.
So if we see any suspicious fires happening at the Fifth Ward Meeting House,
it's going to be under the guidance of these new ordinances.
Okay. So we really don't have any answers to what happens now, but we will absolutely keep you updated on any updates that come about this. So make sure to follow us on our socials because that's where we'll keep you updated.
Yeah, there's other people in other cities listening. You know, this is how you want your city to respond.
Right.
And, you know, if you're in another city that's also battling with this issue, you know, maybe get a copy of the Salt Lake City ordinances and see if your city has similar ordinances. And if not, push for them.
Yep. We can make change happen.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. This podcast was researched and written by us and produced by Mike Gillen. Thank you, as always, Mike. You can find us at Demolished Places Podcast on Instagram, Facebook, Threads, and Twitter, where we post pictures of the places we talk about, as well as other content and updates on what's going on throughout the city. We have some really great episodes coming up. We're really excited for what we have to put out to you guys, and we hope you enjoy it as much as we're enjoying recording them.
Yeah, it's going to be a good season of the podcast.
I agree. Thank you, and we'll see you next time.
Bye.